Hello, everybody, and welcome to a podcast of Biblical Proportions.
Episode 96, Final Thoughts on the Book of Numbers. A long, long time ago, the Hebrews edited their Bible. Biblical editors took all the existing Hebrew texts and their new ones and arranged them along a narrative. But there were some texts that the biblical editors could not fit into that narrative. Some stories, accounts, rules, laws, traditions, ceremonies, and other details stood in contradiction with other texts or with the grand narrative. The editors couldn't really fit them anywhere. And so, they created a new book to house all these undesirable biblical texts that have no connection to one another. A miscellaneous book. The editor's plan was to create such a messy book that no one would dare to parse things out to try and understand the text in the context in which they were written. And the editor's plan worked for more than 2,000 years. Until we got involved and showed some love to this miscellaneous book of misfit texts, rejected and forsaken. And with that, this motley crew of stories, accounts, rules, laws, traditions, ceremonies, and other details, they were rejected and forsaken no longer. The end. This is our story for today. It is a story of our fourth season on the podcast, which focused on the fourth biblical book, Numbers. In Hebrew, this book is called Bamidbar, in the desert, in the wilderness, which is the setting for this book. The Hebrews begin right outside the Hebrew land, but instead of entering it, they are wandering aimlessly, counting themselves, enshrining new traditions, forming new ceremonies, establishing new theology, settling on what is legal and illegal to wear, beefing with neighbors, dividing the future spoils of the land, which they will only conquer in two books, all of this to pass the time until they can double back and return to where they began the book and be ready to enter their land. The narrative in the book of Numbers is going nowhere because it is a miscellaneous book of undesirable biblical texts compiled to conceal them from view. But once you show some love to these unloved texts, you discover a trove of gems. This season we've had texts that were extreme, quirky, absurd, funny, intense, petty, zealous, or plainly contradictory to others. And when read in the context in which they were written, the texts of Numbers shine. And the book turns from a miscellaneous book to a book of lost and found biblical texts. We found some stuff, all right. So how did it all come to be? There's only one way to find out. Let's dive in. I want to thank Matt for joining our tribe on patreon.com/biblicalproportions. Welcome, Matt. Hi, everybody. Thank you for listening. This is Gil. Welcome to the final episode about the Book of Numbers, an episode where we will look back at this season, remind ourselves what we learned, and draw some new conclusions from this season. This is going to be fun. So first, let me remind you about the layers of Numbers. And we know these layers from previous books and seasons. There's a layer from the Babylonian captivity. There's a layer from Persian times, and there's a layer from Maccabean times. And the biggest layer, by far, is the Maccabean one. And the Persian layer is actually made up of two separate layers from that period. So we actually have four layers for Numbers. So here's a quick recap. The oldest layer of Numbers dates back to the 590s BCE, during the Babylonian captivity, prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, okay? The 590s BCE Babylonia. This layer is made of just two stories, which were stitched together in editing, and they are on opposite sides of the political spectrum. One is very populist, and the other is very elitist. and they are identical in setting and characters and problems, but diametrically opposed politically. Yet no biblical scholar has ever noticed that difference. So that's something that I want to focus on in this episode when we'll talk about the oldest layer of numbers. The second oldest layer is from 538 BCE, when the Hebrews returned from Babylonia at the beginning of Persian times. The stories in this layer, they highlight the problems the returnees faced upon reaching the border of their lands. Their two leaders were, metaphorically speaking, at each other's throats. And this episode will be a good opportunity for us to zoom in a bit on these two actual people who left a mark on Hebrew history and thus on world history. I'm talking about Yehoshua and Zerubbabel. So that's the second layer. That's what we'll talk about, these two guys. The third layer is still in Persian times, but now we're in 520 BCE, Egypt. Right? This layer includes one three-chapter comedic fable, which gives a voice to the Hebrews in Egypt during Persian times. That's the story of Balaam, which is actually about Jeremiah. And it has a negative view of Jeremiah, which stands in contrast with the positive view of Jeremiah that the Hebrew priests in Persia had, okay? There is a Persia-Egypt beef going on, and much of it centers around Jeremiah. This episode will be a very good opportunity to talk a little bit about that. So this is layer number three. And the final layer is, as always, Maccabean. In Numbers, we focused on some Zeloty texts, stories about the coup against the priests, and some super late Maccabean additions from as late as around 80 BCE. And like half of Numbers is Maccabean, which was surprising to me. And this episode will be a good opportunity for us to take stock of just how much of the Bible is Maccabean and start to ponder what that means for the big picture we are slowly building on this podcast. Who wrote the Bible, when, why, and for whom? So I've already begun to look into the following books, and I'm starting to realize that the Maccabean layer of the Bible is much more significant than I had realized. So we'll get into that in this episode, and this is the plan for the episode. And I think we're all set to begin our journey. And we begin it in Babylonian times, the beginning of Babylonian captivity. And we know the setting. It's the first wave of Hebrew captives taken in 597 BCE. When the boy king Jehoiachin and his court and thousands of Hebrew workers were taken from Jerusalem and its environs to Babylonia. 597 BCE and Jerusalem would be destroyed 10 years later. So at some point between 597 BCE and 587 BCE, two stories that appear today in Numbers 11 were written. They were stitched together to appear today in Numbers chapter 11. And scholars found that Numbers chapter 11 is made up of two separate stories 150 years ago, and many of them agree that both of them were written during the Babylonian captivity. So far so good. We are aligned with many scholars, so where do we diverge? We diverge on what we pay attention to when it comes to the differences between these two stories. And we then diverge on what we extrapolate from the differences and what we think it means about the writers who wrote these stories and the people they wrote them for. And the reason I want to talk about this is because I think it goes a long way in explaining how all of these scholars fail to notice stuff that someone with no training in biblical scholarship has. And I don't think you need any particular talent or education to identify the crucial difference between these two stories in Numbers 11. And the crucial difference is politics. It's all about politics in its simplest form. Who makes the decisions for everybody? Does everybody get to make the decisions together for everybody? Or does everybody have to listen to whatever one boss tells them? Politics, the people versus the elite. This is the crucial difference between these two stories. But for scholars, for them, there is a much more important difference. Because this is actually a continuous war between Elohists and Yahwehists. Da-da-da. So what does it mean for scholars to be a Elohist or a Yahwist? And it's a little bit funny that we never really got into it on the podcast, even though we spoke so much about the documentary hypothesis. But the documentary hypothesis does two things. It divides the first five books of the Bible into their original layers. That's how we've been doing it. But it does another thing, which is it tells you what the common elements are in each of these layers, and what that teaches us about the groups behind each of these layers. So an easy one is the priestly layer, the priestly source, quote unquote. The texts of this source, they were written by priests. Fantastic, easy. But the two other sources, they are way less clear. These Elohists and Yahwehists. And we've been at this for 4 years now, and we have yet to encounter these groups in the real world. Ooh, but academics tell us that these were the main groups in the formation of the Bible and thus in ancient Hebrew history. Okay? The groups that we saw were made of populists and elitists. And I know what these terms mean. It's not really complicated. Okay? Like according to Wikipedia, even though populism is a contested topic, right? Whether it's anti-democratic populism or democratic populism, it, and I quote, emphasizes the idea of the common people, often in opposition to a perceived elite. It is frequently associated with anti-establishment. Sure, I get it. Geared towards the people, okay? We could call it egalitarianism, okay? A more equal and equitable society. Easy. And elitism? According to Wikipedia, it is the notion that individuals who form an elite, a select group with desirable qualities, they are more likely to be constructive to society and deserve greater influence and authority. The term elitism may be used to describe a situation in which power is concentrated in the hands of a limited number of people. Easy. People with power, who believe that they are better than those without power, otherwise, they would not have all this power, and hence they deserve power and are entitled to more power. Easy, easy. Now, what about these Elohists? Okay, so according to Wikipedia, the Elohist source is so named because of its repeated use of the word Elohim to refer to the Israelite God. Okay, so Elohists are people who call their God Elohim, which means God in Hebrew. Okay. I don't know what are their main goals, attributes, interests. What binds them together is that they call their God Yahweh more often God than Yahweh. Okay, so the Elohist source is characterized by, among other things, an abstract view of God using Horeb instead of Sinai for the mountain where Moses received the laws of Israel, and the use of the phrase fear of God. So, biblical scholars just read the Elohist source stories, and what they found is a common abstract view of God, that their mountain is Horeb and not Sinai, and that they use the phrase fear of God. And what does that mean? Where are these Elohists in the world in history? What do they do? What do they want to do? What don't they want to do? This is a theoretical term that means nothing, okay? Read these stories again, scholars. And what you'll see there is that these stories are populist or egalitarian, okay? What about these Yahwehists? Are they better defined? Okay, well, according to Wikipedia, for Yahwehists, Yahweh is an anthropomorphic figure. He's like a person. both physically and in personality, as when Abraham bargained with Yahweh for the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah, or during the Exodus when Yahweh threatened to destroy the unfaithful Israelites and raise Moses' descendants instead, but relented and did not bring on his people the disaster when dissuaded by Moses. So Yahwists are Hebrews with a less abstract view of the Hebrew God Yahweh. They call him straight up Yahweh all the time. For them, he's more like a person. But what does that teach us about these Yahwists? Okay, there's more. The Yahweh source is unique in emphasizing a close relationship between humans and the soil. This motif is first found in Genesis 2, verse 4, when the first human is called Adam because he is taken from the soil, Adama in Hebrew. Initially, man lives in harmony with the soil, but after a man eats from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Yahweh curses the soil, condemning man to toil for his food and to return into the soil upon death. Later, Cain is a tiller of the soil, Adama. And after murdering his brother, Cain is cursed from the ground. The harmony between man and the soil is seemingly restored with Noah, a man of the soil, who will bring surviving humanity relief from toil. Noah's drunkenness also links humans with the soil, its produce, and corruption. Okay, so Yahwehs have a philosophical view that humans are connected to the soil. Is that it? Is that it? No. Another recurring theme is the boundary between the divine and human realms. Yada, yada, yada. And a third theme is progressive corruption of humanity. Okay. Until someone can point to a single Yahwist and how their Yahwism is manifested in the world, this term means absolutely nothing at all. It's academic, okay? It's vague and empty and meaningless. But these are the common themes biblical scholars found in the elitist stories, okay? They didn't see the elitism there. They didn't see the populism in the Elohist sources. They saw one group using the phrase, the fear of God at the Mount Horeb, and another group, God is angry all the time, and they have the mountain Sinai. And they like the soil. Okay. That's lame. I'm sorry, that's just like so lame. Oh my goodness. If you think that what drives the world is the ins and outs of theories that don't mean anything to the general public and have no effect on the world, then you must be a person whose world is driven by ins and outs of theories that don't mean anything to the general public and don't have any effect on the real world. This is academia, okay? Academics are projecting their own sets of values and beliefs and experiences into the biblical texts, because academia is comprised of clearly defined camps based on minute differences in theories. Okay, theories divide academia. Do you believe in the Exodus theory, or do you think that there was no Exodus, okay? Biblical scholars will go and have gone to war over this theoretical issue, okay? They've gone scorched earth against people with a different theory. And since the fault lies within their academic circles, they are what theory you ascribe to, it seems that they assume that these must be universal and timeless truths. The never-ending battle between fear, between theories. Ooh. I think that history is driven by politics and geopolitics. Events shape the world, and they shape the theories that come out of events and politics and geopolitics. And people are divided not according to theories, but according to material interests. It's not whether they emphasize God's connection to the soil versus the phrase fear of God. Okay, so I'm giving academia a yellow card on this one. Okay, lame, that's lame. It's about politics, come on. It's about who gets to lead. Do the people lead together, or do only a select few get to tell everybody else what to do? This has been a timeless and universal struggle since, after prehistory. Should society be equal, Or should you shut the fuck up and do as you're told or else, hmm? At first, the first difference that made the scholars find the layers, that was whether they used the name Elohim or Yahweh. But that doesn't mean that this is the most crucial and defining element in this text. Come on. Yellow card. Yellow card. This is like from football, right? Soccer. Yellow card. Warning. Two yellow cards. You're ejected from the game. You can also get a straight red. I think this could have been straight red, not noticing. Like the basic political theory, like most basic in these two stories. Who gets to rule? Come on, it's right there. Yellow card and say thanks. I think there's a larger point here about the liberal establishment's failure to understand that class matters and material conditions matter and the theories are only important to them and not to the general public. But I don't want to digress, okay? Because I want to give a final little nod for now for the two people who wrote these two stories in Numbers 11. A populist story and an elitist story. Okay, let's read just a bit. The first one was written by the person with the oldest stories in the Bible so far, Shemaya the Nehelamite. He's the populist, egalitarian. In Shemaya's story, Moses is calling out God to his face. Okay, so apparently he uses often the phrase fear of God, but he does not fear God at all. Okay, he comes at him. And I think that we should read this as Shemaya himself calling out his God in real time in the captivity. Okay, this is his internal monologue at the times the Hebrews are captive in Babylonia, but Jerusalem still stands. There is a home to return to. And Shemaya is attributing his own internal monologue to the protagonist, the leader he created, you know, as a stand-in for himself, because this is how writers write, okay? So here is Shemaya's anguish and anger and how he directs it towards his Elohim. This is a Shakespearean monologue, okay? Moses said to Yahweh, Shemaya said to Yahweh, why have you treated your servant so badly? Why have I not found favor in your eyes that you lay the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give birth to them that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a wet nurse carries a nursing child? I am not able to carry all these people alone, for they are too heavy for me. If this is the way you are going to treat me, put me to death at once. If I have found favor in your eyes, do not let me see my misery. So Yahweh said to Moses, gather for me 70 of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people, and officers over them. Bring them to the tent of meeting and have them take their place there with you. I will come down and speak with you there, and I will take some of the spirit that is on you and put it on them, and they shall bear the burden of the people along with you, so that you will not bear it all by yourself. Take a bow, Shemaya. Wow, that's a great monologue. And he's a populist through and through. Problem solved with everybody working together. So now let's get to the other story, written by a man who does not use the term fear of God, but he wants everybody to fear God. Okay? And he has an opposing perspective. This is Ezekiel the priest. He is our elitist Yahwist writer. Let's read a little bit from Numbers 11, his story. Now when the people complained in the hearing of Yahweh about their misfortunes, Yahweh heard it, and his anger was kindled. Then the fire of Yahweh burned against them and consumed some of the outlying parts of the camp. But the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to Yahweh, and the fire abated. So that place was called Tavera, fire, because the fire of Yahweh burned against them. You complain, you die. The boss doesn't want to hear anything you have to say unless it's thank you, sir. You got that? All of you, Do I need to burn some more people for you to shut your freaking mouths and do as you're told? No? We're good? Good. Man, these Yahwists were crazy! So now we leave Babylonian times behind us. It will take us a long time until we get back there. And we're heading into Persian times. The fantastic Persian times. Persian times were stable and nice and good and comfy, and they included the greatest miracle in ancient Hebrew history, the return to Zion. Persia conquered Babylonia in 539 BCE, and on the first day of spring, 538 BCE, a few thousand Hebrews returned from Babylonia to their ancestral homeland. Hallelujah. The Hebrews left saying hallelujah and eventually settled saying hallelujah, but this season we got to see the in-between of these two hallelujahs. One hallelujah for leaving Babylonia and another when they resettled their land. But we found out that in between of these two hallelujahs, there was loads of drama. The return did not go as planned. Maybe because the plan included magical beads clearing the way for them? I don't know. Okay. So what is Numbers all about? Okay. It's a miscellaneous book. But even though it's a miscellaneous book, it still has a distinct core. And that distinct core is the implosion of the Hebrew returnees upon learning in the summer of 538 BCE that their holy land was not waiting for them with open arms. Nope, nope, nope. That's the core of Numbers. Okay, Bamidbar in Hebrew, in the desert. Because this is the event that created the setting of the Hebrews wandering aimlessly in the desert or wilderness. The glorious return of 538 BC concluded anticlimactically. So the original stories about the Hebrews wandering in the desert are dramatized historical accounts about what actually happened in that summer, that autumn, that winter of 538 BC. I am absolutely positive that this actually happened in 538 BCE, but I want to be clear about what I'm basing this on. Like up to now, matching stories to historical events was relatively easy. I should say you just need to look and it's there because we have historical accounts and then we have stories and they match. Okay, we saw that a million times and we will see it a million times more. But there are no historical accounts of the summer, autumn, and winter months of 538 BCE. So there is nothing to match these stories to. So what I did in this case is assume that since all the biblical stories that we saw are stories about actual things that happened with matching historical accounts, and the overall picture is perfect and rich, and since we know from history that the return to Zion definitely was not an instant success, nope, 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 I had no choice but to assume slash conclude that the scouts' stories about the implosion of the community absolutely had to be based on real events. We just didn't have matching historical accounts. But the pattern is identical. Stories about historical accounts, and they match the historical timeline. And when we went over these scout stories, the emotion, drama, and distress, they were palpable. Okay, so I just could not see how this batch of stories would be, for some unknown reason, completely different in terms of what drives the Hebrews to write than anything else so far, and they just made it up, even though it fits everything and it feels real. This is the same kind of stories. They are clearly stories about real things. Otherwise, there would be no reason to write these specific stories in such detail with so much emotion and just to run your narrative into the ground for no reason. It harms the plot, okay, actively. Like, this is the weak point of the biblical narrative, okay? Like, Genesis is amazing, Exodus is epic, Leviticus has the Hebrews learning about the rules, and then, at the end, setting out to their ancestral homeland. And Numbers has them not going in, but wandering around for an entire book, having adventures along the way. If this implosion is there, and if it feels real, if it works with everything, if it fits our overall picture, then there's no reason to think that it is any different than the other texts we already went over. Hence, they are dramatized historical accounts. I think they reflect real historical events. So the community of returnees split up until it eventually coalesced again under the priests, who led the first Hebrew returnees across the Jordan River and into their land. And the community eventually coalesced under the top priest of that time, Joshua, son of Jehozadak. But he became number one only after his boss died, and he succeeded him from number two to number one. The number one was Zerubbabel, son of Jehoiachin. Jehoiachin, the exiled boy king, taken to captivity in 597 BCE, together with Shemaiah and Ezekiel. So let's talk a bit about Zerubbabel and Joshua, Yehoshua. We spoke quite a lot about them through the stories when they are the stand-ins, you know, Moses and Aaron, and they rib each other, but only now I had a reason to like really look into them for like a broader picture, and I should make some corrections. So most scholars think and agree that they are not the sons of the former king and the former high priest, respectively, but their grandsons, okay? I'll look more into it when there's a reason, but apparently Zerubbabel, he is Jehoiachin's grandson. Apparently I missed it. In between there is Shealtiel, okay? And Yehoshua's grandfather, Sariah, he was the last high priest before the destruction. His son was Jehozadak, and then came Joshua. And Joshua and Zerubbabel, they are joined and tied at the hip. Wherever there's one, there's the other. And Zerubbabel appears in several prophecies and fantasies. And I think that his premature death was a blow. And that he became a little bit like Elvis. You know, like people thought to themselves, oh, he can't really be dead. Nah, he's coming back. He's the last heir to the royal line. So then they attribute to him rebuilding the temple or doing this and that. He's very important, okay? And in the New Testament, he's also included in the genealogy of Jesus, okay? Because he was important and he left a mark. His disappearance seems to have left a mark, okay? And we'll just have to reconstruct who he was as we move along the biblical books. It will probably take us a few years to get back to him, which is why I'm giving the overall picture now, okay? But Joshua, Yehoshua, he's going nowhere, okay? We will see him in the next book and the book after that, okay? So that's that about the first layer of Persian times, okay, from 538 BCE. Now I want to move to the Egypt versus Persia beef, okay? Hebrew edition. The Hebrews who immigrated to Egypt after the destruction of Jerusalem, they became an open, prosperous, happy, and fruitful society. And they were super cool with the local traditions in Egypt, both when it was pharaonic, and then, of course, when it became Persian. And they had no priests. They didn't have any priests. The priests, they were taken to Babylonia. So they developed a separate Hebrew culture and theology and experience, completely separate from their Hebrew brethren in Babylonian later Persia, which was dominated by priests. These are two different communities. And when Persia freed the Hebrews from Babylonia, that was the basis for the religion of the priests. The return to Zion, the miracle, the covenant. And when Persia conquered Egypt in 525 BC, and they could send each other their texts, the priest read Jeremiah's texts and then concluded that he spoke the words of Yahweh. And if Yahweh is perfect, that means that Jeremiah was perfect too. But the people who knew him best, they begged to differ. And the two communities differed on several things. And some of these differences, they can be found in the differences between the Hebrew Bible and its Greek translation, the Septuagint. In the 300s and then 200s and later, the Hebrews in Hellenistic Egypt translated the Bible into Greek. And there are still differences between the Hebrew version and its translation into Greek. Like usually the original language is the original, But with so many rounds of editing and changes, that is not necessarily true, not in this case. In fact, I began going over all of these little differences between the Hebrew version and the Greek one with my friend and frequent collaborator, Gary Stevens from the History in the Bible podcast. And we're launching a series of episodes which will track the differences between the Masoretic text, as the Hebrew version is called, and the Septuagint. And the differences are not random. We saw these differences in the tales of Balaam. The Hebrews in Egypt, they did not like Jeremiah. The Hebrews in Persia thought he was a Messiah. Okay? And you can see these differences not only in the book, not only in the tales of Balaam, but also in the different versions of the book of Jeremiah. The Hebrew one and the Greek one. The Greek one is closer to the Hebrews in Egypt and what they thought about Jeremiah. And the Hebrew one is closer to the Hebrews in Persia who adored Jeremiah. Once you understand that, you understand why these two versions are different. They are always explained by this difference, okay? We already recorded an episode about it, okay? And that will be coming up next week. And it will set the stage a little bit for this Egypt versus Persia beef Hebrew edition. So that's that about further insights and thoughts about the Persian layer of numbers. Now let's move on to Maccabean times. There's so much Maccabean stuff in Numbers. And there is so much Maccabean stuff in the Bible. You wouldn't believe how much of the Bible is Maccabean. And this is a good opportunity to begin talking about that. So if you remember, at the beginning of the season of Exodus, I first found small Maccabean additions to the book, and they were few and far between. Most of Exodus is from Babylonian and Persian times. Leviticus has quite a lot of Maccabean stuff, like a quarter or a third, but when it comes to Numbers, 50% of it is Maccabean. So that's something already to consider and reckon with. 50% of this book is Maccabean, from 140 BCE to 80 BCE, supremely late. What about the upcoming books? Deuteronomy is coming next, and I'm here to report that it is more than 95% Maccabean. Okay, 95% Maccabean at least. Forget about the D source, the Deuteronomistic source. No, this is the M source, M for Maccabean. Scholars see later a Deuteronomistic historian and editor. Nah, that's not a thing. Deuteronomistic, this is an academic term that doesn't exist outside of academia. Okay, this is a theory. The Deuteronomistic historian and editor is a Maccabean historian and editor. So Deuteronomy is 95% Maccabean. Joshua is about the same, 95% Maccabean, I think. Judges seems to me to be at least 70% Maccabean. Then we get to the books of Samuel, which are about 50% Maccabean. And then we get to the books of Kings, which were edited by the same group. So the version we have is the Maccabean version, the Maccabean story. Okay, so that's just so much Maccabean stuff in the Bible. Okay, just think about it. Genesis through Kings, that's about half the Bible. And I think that when it's all said and done, about half of it, if not 60% of it, will end up being Maccabean. That's wild. And all this Maccabean stuff waiting for us, okay, in the coming years, it will be 100% perfectly aligned with everything we learned about the Maccabees, when they wrote, what was important to them, and how this bears itself out in the text. They're like, okay, we're going to have to transfer more wealth from the wealthy to the people. Let's transfer lands from the wealthy to the people. Let's focus on anti-statues ideology, since this was the main theological beef with the statue-worshipping priests. We'll also have More stories about Shimon Tassi, his son John Hyrcanus, his son Alexander. And there's Judah the Maccabee waiting for us at all. Wow, 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 wow. All of them will appear under stand-ins. So the Bible is not what we thought. And you heard it first. The Bible is super Maccabean. Okay, we'll better begin to get used to it and enjoy it. We're going to spend so much time in Maccabean times, which is honestly for me my favorite period, because it's so relevant for our world, and we have so many colors and shades and details that you can really get a strong feel for it. So just prepare mentally. In the coming years, a lot of Maccabean times and a lot of Maccabean Bible. Okay, so that's that. Now you know your book of Numbers, a book of undesirable texts, which we loved for a whole season. We have one book left. We have one book left in the Torah, the Pentateuch. The next book, Deuteronomy, is totally different, opposite even, than this miscellaneous book. Okay, it's absolutely beautiful. And about 85% of it is like one chunk, one unit that was published in one single day. Okay, it was not written in a single day, of course, but it was published as a unit in one day, about 85% of it, maybe 80%, okay? I think this unit was read aloud to the Hebrews on the day of Hebrew independence in 140 BCE. I think it was read by the Hebrew leader at that time, Shimon Tassi, who stood on the mount of the Jerusalem temple and gave a long sermon on that mount to the thousands and maybe more Hebrews who gathered in Jerusalem for the occasion. And this will be how I will want to read it in the next season. This was their miracle and their new covenant. For the priests, the day of their return to Zion, that was the centerpiece of their covenant with Yahweh. Everything revolved around that miracle. But for the Maccabees, the day of Hebrew independence, that was the centerpiece of their new covenant with Yahweh, and everything revolved around that miracle, okay? Hebrew independence in 140 BCE was a miracle. No other small people in the Seleucid Empire were able to carve out their own independent state like in the middle of this humongous empire. Come on. And the Hebrews saw this as a miracle by Yahweh. They now had a covenant for this miracle. For the occasion, they had a book published, 85% of Deuteronomy. It's absolutely beautiful and moving and wow. My challenge for the season of Deuteronomy would be to convey that wow to you. In the translation, it is translated as if it was Leviticus or Numbers when it is not. So I will have to work hard to make the English equally beautiful to the Hebrew of Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy is crucial for biblical scholarship. And sadly, we'll see next season they'll get, I think, a straight red card there. Okay, come on. Terrible. Terrible. I'm honestly shocked, but we'll get to that next season. I should say that scholars also agree that Deuteronomy stands out for its beautiful and evolved Hebrew. And still they date it to Assyrian times. Okay. Deuteronomy is beautiful because it was written as a speech to be read aloud to regular people. That's why it's so clear and beautiful. Okay, so that's a sneak peek about Deuteronomy. And I'm also actively working on the following season of Joshua and that of Judges. I want to do all three as close as I can to each other, without a long off-season. But this off-season will last a little bit longer so that I can prepare for all of them. So I'll begin the Deuteronomy season at the beginning of January 2026. Okay? But till then, my intention is to post weekly collaborations. Right? The first one will be with Gary Stevens, reviewing the differences between the Hebrew version and the Greek version of Jeremiah. And then I want to get through all of these three books, Deuteronomy, Joshua, and Judges, and maybe a bit of Samuel in 2026, okay? So check back in next week to learn about the differences in the two versions of the book of Jeremiah. And until then, I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank the members of the tribe over on patreon.com/biblicalproportions for being awesome and allowing me to do this podcast. And I want to thank all the writers who contributed to the book of Numbers and to the editors who were able to conceal all the cracks and fissures between the texts. Good job, everybody. Good job. So let me sign off on the season of Numbers. I'm Gil Kidron. Bye.